Good morning. I'm pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Dr. Carolyn Finney. My name is Ryan Owens, your moderator for today and the executive director of the Monadnock Conservancy, the sponsor of today's event. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's musicians, the Apple Hill String Quartet, for recording the music many of you enjoyed while waiting for the live broadcast to begin. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported primarily through contributions from our audience. We deeply appreciate your donations, which this year may be made on our website or by mailing your donation. During this challenging time, we need your help more than ever. Today's talk is being recorded and will soon be available as a podcast and as a video on our website, monadnocklyceum.org. The talk will also be rebroadcast on WUML 91.5 on Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. and next Sunday at 3 p.m. and on WSMN 95.3 next Sunday at 7 a.m. and 4 p.m. As is the tradition of the Lyceum, after the presentation, our speaker will answer questions from the audience. Please submit your questions by using the live comments section on Facebook or YouTube, or send them to our email at monlyceum@gmail.com. After the broadcast, we invite you to provide feedback on today's program, suggestions for next summer's speakers, or join our mailing list through our website. Our speaker today is Dr. Carolyn Finney. I had the honor of first meeting Carolyn 10 years ago when I was a participant and she a faculty member at a week-long retreat for young conservation leaders. We were contemplating the future of our field as we sought to serve a public that, demographically, racially, and socioeconomically, looked increasingly unlike those people purported to have founded and built the land conservation movement. Her influence on my work then and now has been profound. In recent years, and especially in the past year, a great many voices have emerged at the intersection of race, nature, and privilege. But Carolyn's is different, and not only because she was addressing these issues before most anyone else. Carolyn is not a lecturer. Rather, she's a storyteller. Drawing on an astounding breadth of lived experiences, she seeks to engage her audience emotionally, telling her stories in such a way that we can not only hear them, but also feel them. I couldn't possibly summarize Carolyn's background in the time I have, so I'll simply name a few facets that, to me, define her. It would be tempting to call her an academic, but I suspect she would resist that label as too confining. Rather, she is an actor, a world-traveling backpacker, an activist, an author, most notably of Black Faces, White Spaces, reimagining the relationship of African Americans to the great outdoors. A researcher of women and international rural development, an advisor to the National Park Service, a cultural geographer, an artist. Dr. Carolyn Finney, thank you and welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum.
Ryan, thank you for that wonderful introduction. I love to hear how, you know, people categorize and think about me. You nailed it, my friend, you nailed it. I appreciate you. Good morning to everyone who has joined today, Monadnock, for the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you for allowing me to be in your space. I wish we were all together in person, so I'm just going to dream on that for a second. I want to thank Meredith Martin. I want to thank Bob Herring-Smith, Ryan Owens, of course, and all of you for letting me kind of show up in the space today. So when you see me look down, this is me looking at my notes, trying to stay on task because I tend to riff a little bit. But so there's some things I want to talk about today. First, I want to tell you, I always give my talks a title. And the actual title today was The N-Word, Nature Revisited, Conversations with John Muir and Others. And a little bit, I'm going to tell you how and why I've come to that. I came to that maybe 4 or 5 years ago, actually. It's something I've been working on, The N-Word, Nature Revisited, a conversation, an imagined conversation with John Muir. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But I always like to start with where I am. and where we are collectively. I mean, I don't want to presume to know exactly where you are, but I mean sort of where we are metaphorically at this particular time. And when I look at my notes, I wrote the climate change report, which just came out, which was kind of devastating. But I want to say, not really anything new there. The climate change report, COVID, everything that's been happening with COVID recently, the rise of the Delta variant. And what I'm primarily here to talk about today, systemic racism and what many of us are calling a racial reckoning, particularly since last summer. The reason I want to call attention to the obvious, like these are three huge things that are happening right now, not the only things, is because for me, we are all affected. We're not all affected in the same way, at the same time, and in the same place, but we are all affected. We are all affected because we are all connected, either to each other and or to this place. And so we're experiencing these things, whether we like it or not, whether we agree with them or not, whether we even notice them or not. We are connected in some ways and are affected by that. I think when we talk about, there's so many ways I can continue to say it, systemic racism, racial reckoning, diversity and inclusion. I always say lately that we're playing the long game on this, right? I always tell people there's no end game. For me, there's no end game. It's a long game because part of engaging the question of diversity and difference broadly defined, right, is really about relationship, you know, our relationship to each other and really looking at that in the past and here in the present as we think about how we might move forward together collectively in the future. So for me, it's largely about playing the long game. And I've been thinking about how, you know, you watch the news every night. I watch the news every night. Some nights I have to tell you that I have to take a break from the news, but I generally watch the news every night and think about, for some of us, right, we're way behind that. Like if there's a continuum about in terms of how people are responding to this idea of diversity and inclusion and systemic racism and the racial reckoning, there are people who are way behind on it and are seriously confused or resistant even to the idea of what that is or that it's something that actually exists. There are others of us who are chomping at the bit and who have been on the front lines our entire lives, thinking about it, showing up in that. And then there's a whole lot of folks somewhere in the middle, right? It's confusing, it's frustrating, it's scary for some. It is challenging. Because actually what it means is that no one gets to be comfortable anymore. I'll come back to that later too, as to say that some of us have never been fully comfortable, but no one gets to be comfortable anymore, right? So there's a moment of reexamination that's happening as well. And also that it's anything but linear, right? This isn't something for me that happened. Something happened yesterday, it's happening today and will happen tomorrow, or we're gonna change it for tomorrow. It's happening in so many different ways, in so many different spaces, in coming up in so many different forms. So part of it is how do we address it? How do we recognize it? How do we choose to engage it? I wrote here in my notes, it's in our cultural DNA. It's hardwired into our memory, both ancestral and otherwise. I always like to say, wherever we go, there we are. So when people say to me, well, that happened a long time ago, as though it's something so far in our past that has nothing to do with our present, and I just go back to them and say, wherever we go, there we are, right? So if you think that none of that is showing up with you, I'm here to really offer you a different way to look at that, because we can never leave anything behind. There's always the repercussions of that, the resonance of that, and the way that's showing up. And I think in particular in 2020, for some people, it was for the first time, got to really see how that plays out. I'm saying all this as well because, you know, whenever I start to put a talk together, even if I'm going to say some things that I've said 100 times before, and I have to tell you that I was telling Bob earlier that since last year alone, I've probably done 150 events at least online. I have to start with where I am at any given moment. And the truth of the matter is that I often feel stressed out about this conversation, kind of despondent just in general, and often alone. I should have started off by saying that I'm speaking to you from Burlington, Vermont. I moved here in 2019 because I do a part-time residency at Middlebury College in their Franklin Environmental Center. And the rest of the time, I'm usually on a plane somewhere, except for this past year, but I live alone. And, you know, that usually doesn't mean anything, except for this past year, I've been alone a lot, having these conversations with people. And so I stand in that place feeling tired, like a lot of people, feeling a little overwhelmed, like a lot of people, but also still feeling optimistic and hopeful, right? And there's a tension there in holding that for me. What does it mean to continue to be optimistic, to continue to be grateful, even for the opportunity to engage with you right now, and also honor my own sort of limitations as a human being about, in terms of how I feel and how I bring that to the table. And so I ask myself the question and I ask you the question, you know, what do I believe is possible? What do you believe is possible? And what is required to meet that and meet this moment? What is required by me and what is required by you? So a couple of weeks ago, I got invited to a wedding here in Vermont. And it was, you know, like a lot of us, we started to have our first outdoor activities in the last 6 weeks or so. And so this was a pretty big wedding. And this was a really diverse wedding. Now, Vermont isn't, one could argue, is not really that ethnically and racially diverse. There's other kinds of diversity here, but I just want to point that out as a person who, you know, I'm African American, so there's a way. But this was one of the most diverse weddings I've ever been to anywhere, right? And there's a reason for that. I'm not going to say who the people were getting married, but they, you know, they just it reflected their relationship within the community and within the state in terms of who they had in the room. There were all kinds of folks in the room from all different kinds of walks of life in the room. And it was amazing. It was a beautiful wedding and it was outdoors. This open tent. So I hadn't been to a wedding in years, right? And I like to think that weddings are places where there's a lot of joy. There's a lot of love in the room. People come in are warm and open. I hardly knew anyone. I think I knew maybe 6 or 7 people there because I'm fairly new to the community. So I hardly knew anyone, but I felt relaxed. You know, my guard was down. It was fun to get dressed up. It was fun to be outdoors. It was fun to watch two people pledge their love to each other and do it in public, right? In a way that the rest of us could witness for them, right? So I'm having a good time. There's champagne flowing. There's good food. There's music playing. There was the bathrooms. I know y'all are like, why is she talking about the bathrooms? But just follow me for a second. So the restrooms, because it was outdoors, was set up in this really clever trailer. It was a trailer, and it was set up with traditional gender roles. So men on one side, traditional men, women on the other. And inside, there were 2 stalls and a sink. And it was actually really clever because it was air conditioned and it happened to be really humid and hot that day. And I actually think that a lot of us were just going to the bathroom just because it was air conditioning. So it was a way to step inside. So maybe you could fit 3 people in at a time. So, the wedding had been going on for a while. I went into the restroom and I walked into the trailer. There was a young white woman who was clearly one of the staff working there because she was dressed in black and she had a mic on and, you know, she looked like she was busy, but she was at the sink washing her hands. And there was an older white woman, probably around the same age as me, you know, early 60s, late 60s, somewhere around there. And we were doing that thing you do when you meet people you don't know and you're at a wedding. Everybody's like, oh, isn't this beautiful? And everybody's just feeling that joy and happiness. Now, the space is quite small. So me and the woman, the older woman, were talking. We're standing by the door. The young woman's at the sink washing her hands. My guard is down. And the next thing I know, the woman looks at me and says, can I touch your hair? Now, I want to tell you, I was telling somebody this later. I said, in my head, right, the young woman at the sink froze for a second, and she's just suddenly vigorously washing her hands, like trying to disappear and fade away into the woodwork. That's what I thought was happening. But she couldn't get out because we were blocking the door. Now, this has happened to me before. It's happened to me a lot before. But it hadn't happened to me in a while, particularly since 2020 and what has been a really public conversation about race in this country, what's appropriate in this country, representation, talk, you know, what it is, how do we talk to each other across that ethnic racial difference? What does it mean to be a white person talking to a black person? What's appropriate? What's not? We've been having this conversation a lot, right? So much so that I forgot that actually, well, we may have been having this conversation, but what we put into practice doesn't always play out. And this woman, you could tell, like, it was all good intention. Like, she was absolutely clueless how that landed on me. Like, I don't know you. How would you ever go up to a stranger and ask him if you could touch their hair? I am not your property. I am not something you can exoticize. Like, all this stuff was going through my head. And I was tired. I didn't come to this wedding to work, to do this labor. I also didn't want to break the spell of the joy. So now if I say something perceived as negative, I'm going to be the angry Black woman, the woman who just, like, you know, she was just being friendly. What's my problem? I'm too sensitive. Like, all of this is running through my head, right? So in a moment of complete loss and forgot, I just forgot, I literally went, sure. I said it just like that. And she reached out and started touching my hair. And then she kept going. She kept talking about, so tell me how you do your, and she just kept, and she was trying to compliment me and tell me how, whatever she thought, beautiful going on. But it was such a, you know, it took me from this place of feeling like I'm with everyone, we're all having a good time, to I just shrunk. She had diminished me, and I knew she didn't even know she did it, which made it actually harder. Right? Because I didn't know how to change the vibe in the room for myself. I'm now having to leave that bathroom. I now have to work through it psychologically so I can show up and be present and still have a good time. And the woman is totally clueless. I don't think the young woman at the sink was clueless, but she was totally clueless. And so I'm telling you all this to say that I'm also thinking about what does it mean for us at this moment to do a thing, to practice a thing that we're all talking about. What does it actually mean to do that? And how do we each feel about that? And how do I feel about that? So there's this incredible African-American lawyer named Bryan Stevenson, and some of you may have heard about him. There's a documentary on HBO called True Justice. Now, Bryan Stevenson, he started the Equal Justice Initiative. He's been to the Supreme Court at least 5 times. He fights to get primarily African-American men and often teenagers off death row. He's really an incredible soul. And when I saw this documentary, I had heard about him. He's done a TED Talk. Really, if when you get a moment, please look this man up. I just was moved by who he was. I think I wrote down every time he opened his mouth, I was like, oh, that's a great quote. I wrote that down. Now, what I discovered is we're actually born one day apart, same year, same month, just one day apart. So I feel like I'm really connected to him. The man doesn't know me, but I feel really connected to him. In the interview, in the documentary, the interviewer, one of the reasons I also feel connected to him is because he's alone. He doesn't have a partner. He doesn't have kids. And he is all about his work, at least from the public side, what we see is all about his work. And that's a lot like me. I don't have a partner. I don't have kids. I'm 61 years old. And it's all about my work. And I mean that in the best way, even though I have lots of great relationships with friends and family, but not immediately. And so the interviewer asked him, you know, why do you do what you do? And one of the first things he said was, the system is broken. You know, so he's kind of trying to attend to that. And he kept talking and he said, well, and people are broken. People come to me and they're broken. And then it's like he was on this journey thinking about it. And then he just looked at the interviewer and said, I do what I do because I'm broken too. And that I wrote down. And that's what I broke down too. Because I said, that's the truth of it, right? So at the core of all of this is about healing, not just healing the system, not just healing others outside of ourselves, but also healing ourselves. And what does that entail in order for us to show up and do that? So people who've heard me speak before know that I often start off with my own story because I have to. I have to talk about why this is personal. I say to people, you know, this is personal, this is political, this is intimate. For me, you know, I hope that's true for everybody, but I know that it's not always true for everybody. But for me, it is. I also always say that all knowledge is subjective. We bring who we are to bear upon anything it is we're trying to understand. We We look through our own eyes and our own experience. This for me is not a bad thing or a good thing. It's just a true thing. And that we're all biased as a result. And for me, bias is not necessarily good or bad. It is often just a point of view. Now, bias exists in close relationship, I think, with prejudice as well as racism. They all kind of operate in a really interesting way, like a complicated family. And if we are not aware of our own bias, it can trip over into that without us even realizing that that's happening. And so I have to talk about my own bias. And so I have to tell you a little bit of my own story. So my parents, I have to start with my parents, Rose and Henry, who are from Floyd, Virginia, which is a small town, not so small anymore, near Roanoke, Virginia, near the Blue Ridge Mountains. They grew up there in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. They grew up poor. They both have a high school education, grew up in large families, very near each other. My father went off to fight in the Korean War in the 1950s, and when he came back, he tried to get a job. He talks about how he told me how he saw a park ranger in a park ranger uniform, and he thought that looked like a great government job. And when he went to apply, what they told him was, "I'm sorry, but we don't hire Negroes." So for my father and my mother as well, this was part of the impetus to move north as part of the Great Migration. So they moved to New York. My father had a sister in New York who was a nurse, who had married a contractor and seemed to be doing well. So it seemed like there's a little family there. We'll come up here and see what we can make happen. My father had two job offers. The first was in Syracuse, New York, which is 5 hours north of New York City. He was offered the job of a janitor, but he didn't take that job. Instead, he took a job 30 minutes outside of New York City in Westchester County. A very wealthy family, a Jewish family, a very wealthy family, who owned a lot of real estate, had a 12-acre estate in Westchester County. This 12-acre estate, stunning. Flower gardens, vegetable gardens, fruit trees, a small pond with actual fish in it, swimming pool, a long driveway, just a stunning piece of property. There was a gardener's cottage, and then there's a bigger house that the owners would come to on weekends and holidays. They also had an apartment in New York City. My father took that job. That meant he was the landscape gardener. He was the full-time caretaker, as was my mother. He was also the chauffeur. And my mom, in the beginning, was sometimes the housekeeper for when the owners would come up, largely on weekends and holidays, and she eventually stopped doing that. She was not happy about that. Both her mother, as well as my father's mother, had been maids to white families back in the South, so she wasn't trying to continue that legacy. All white, incredibly wealthy neighborhood. Harry Winston had property down the street. Schaefer of Schaefer Beer, some of you may remember Schaefer Beer, but lived next door. Wingfoot Golf Club around the corner. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood until the 1990s. A Japanese American woman moved in. She was there for a few years and moved out. And I'm telling you this to give you just a sense of what it might have felt like for my parents, Rose and Henry, to move into this neighborhood where they knew no one, where they were not like anyone, and where they were the only ones living there who worked there but did not own the land on which they worked. My parents wanted to have kids. And something that happened to my mom, which happens, I think, to a lot of women who don't have money from all walks of life, particularly back in the 50s, was she had gone into the hospital to get assist on one of her ovaries removed. And without asking her permission, they removed the cyst, and then they removed her other ovary. They told her later the reason they didn't ask her is because they didn't think she could emotionally handle the information. So she didn't think she could have kids. This actually benefited me. With the help of the owners, they adopted me. And I didn't realize this until a couple of years ago, that actually it was the owners who really paid for and engineered my adoption from the Spence Chapin Adoption Agency in New York City, which is still there today. So my parents adopted me. And then what I always tell audiences is, 2 years later, they relaxed and they had my brother Greg. And then a couple of years after that, they relaxed some more and had my brother John. All right. So me and my brothers, we had the run of that 12 acres during the course of the week. This is where my relationship with nature was formed, really. You know, this is where I learned how to ride a bike. I knew how to swim by the time I was seven. Me and my brothers had to. excuse me, because there was so much water on that property. We were outside all the time. There's wildlife on the property. I mean, it was just part of our regular experience. There's 101 stories I could tell you about my first pet, which was a duck, and there's a whole story there. And there's a lot of stories I could tell you, but the one that I tend to tell audiences around this country, I mean, around, yes, around this country, but also around this topic of race, is one day when I was in fourth grade, walking home from school. I went to a public school, and I was right around the corner from the house. So you have to picture me fourth grade, right? I had these little reading glasses and my little afro, you know. And there was a white policeman in the car, and there was often policemen patrolling this neighborhood, this up and down, because of all the wealth. And when I was right around the corner from the house, he stopped me, and he wanted to know where I was going. And I gave him the full address, and 1000 Old White Plains Road, it's a long address. And he looked at me and said, "Oh, do you work there?" And I'm thinking, I'm nine, you know. What I said was, "No, I live there." But I was confused. And he said, "Oh," maybe he was confused too, but he let me go. I went home. I told my parents. My father got furious. He called the police station, and he really gave them hell about it and said, "Please do not bother my daughter or my sons again." And they didn't after that. But as an adult, I have to ask, what were the logics there? I was 9 years old, school bag, time of day, little girl. There was a lot of clues to what I may or may not have been doing. The policeman didn't ask me, did I need help getting home? Did I know where I was going? Even just to say hello, you know, I'm the policeman here in the neighborhood, you know, to make sure you're safe. There was none of that. He was challenging me, and all he could do was imagine that I must be working there. And I have to ask myself, what's up? So I want to jump ahead. I want to jump ahead into the 1990s. Now, the family, it's complicated when you work for a family that you also live on their land and you are intertwined in all kinds of ways. I'm not here at all to badmouth the owners of the property. It's way too complicated for that. Love is a complicated thing. I want to say that the patriarch of the family had died many years earlier. The matriarch of the family in the 90s got sick. Now my parents have been caring for this land for nearly 40 years, right? And she started to think about, you know, I'm going to pass away. What's going to happen to my family? And she considered trying to keep them on this land, except that land was worth over $3 million in the 90s. Property taxes are over $125,000 a year. She's thinking it's not going to work to keep them on this property. So a lot of conversation. Can she buy the land next door? There was a lot of conversation of where they can go. At the end of the day, they landed on Leesburg, Virginia, because at this point, me and my brothers had already left the nest. We're building our lives out in the world. But my youngest brother was the only one who was taking a more traditional route. He had gotten married, was having kids, bought a house, and this was in Leesburg. So the owners had a beautiful house built for my parents. It's a lovely house in Leesburg on a half an acre of land. She passed away, the original owner, with my father at her bedside, by the way. And the new owner came on. He came on in the late 90s. My parents stayed on with him till 2003. He tried to get my parents to stay, actually, even longer. Now my parents are in their 70s, right? Now they've been caring for this land for nearly 50 years. The fact of the matter is you need somebody caring for this land full time, right? This isn't just like someone's backyard where you can mow the land on the, you know, yard on the weekend. You actually need somebody who can be attentive to it on a daily basis. At the end of the day, my parents left and moved into their new home in 2003. He eventually found, for a little while, a family from the Dominican Republic who moved in our place. I watched when my parents moved. Especially I watched my dad get really depressed. All he did was start talking about the land and missing the land. He started talking about how he had no land to hand down to us, no legacy of what that was. I, of course, by listening to my father, I was able to sort of disconnect from how I felt about missing the land, right? So I sort of focused on my parents and the way they missed the land. A few years after they moved, they received a copy of a letter. It was from the Westchester Land Trust. And the letter had gone out to all their old neighbors in their old neighborhood, letting everyone there know that a conservation easement had now been placed on this piece of land. Now, a conservation easement means, and apart from a whole lot of other things, was that in perpetuity, nothing here can be changed. It's going to be protected. It talked about the environmental values of that property. It talked about the wildlife. It talked about the fauna, the flora on that property. It talked about where it sat in the watershed and the reason why it needed to be protected. At the end of that letter, which I have, it said, it thanked the new owner for his conservation mindedness. Now, he'd been on the land maybe 4 or 5 years at that point. There was nothing in the letter acknowledging my parents who had cared for, stewarded that land for nearly 50 years. And just like that, my family was erased. Just like that, my parents' labor was erased. Just like that, they were gone from the environmental history of that land. Now, at this point, yeah, I had returned to school and I'm working on my doctorate and I had been looking at environmental issues in gender. And man, I really started. This is one of the reasons it got so personal for me to think about what does that mean to be erased? What does it mean when we think about the myth of Black people don't in terms of the environment? And I'm like, but that's just a myth, actually, because Black people do. You know why? Because we're human. Like everybody else, right? Of course we do. We've always shown up in the environment. We've always been there in the environment. Maybe not like everyone else, but we have been there. And so that's really when it became a personal mission for me in many ways to really change that story. Not create a new story as though it didn't exist, but actually unearth that old story that's always been there. And it also is for me about re-examining the relationship we have to each other in our past, as well as in the present, as we think about each other. So now I want to jump ahead a little bit. I'm going to come back to that story in a minute. One of the things that happened for me in 2020 around this conversation was that about 70% of my income is from doing talks and showing up and running workshops and having this conversation. I love doing what I do. I just want you to be really clear about that. Right. I had worked over years and I also write about this. Right. So I've been working for, I would say, the last 6 or 7 years really intentionally on creating that platform. I decided to leave my full time position in academia, which is something I had always hoped to do anyway. Still keep a relationship with an academic institution, but sort of stand outside so I could wholly show up in a more creative fashion to engage people, to meet people where they are in this conversation and to do this work. By the time it hit, I would say last March, right, when COVID hit, and suddenly I'm not traveling anywhere because I'm sitting here in my apartment, you know, I thought, oh my God, what's going to happen now? And for about a month, everything disappeared. And then people started to switch to having this virtual conversation. About a month or so or two after that, George Floyd got murdered. Within that same 12-hour period, Christian Cooper, the gay Black birder, walked into Central Park and had his skin weaponized against him. Right after that, The Guardian asked me to write a piece. What they asked was they wanted a piece about Christian Cooper and the environmental conversation. What I said to them was, this isn't only about Christian Cooper and the environmental conversation as though it's separate. It's actually on a continuum. George Floyd and Christian Cooper. On one end, you have, as a Black person, you could potentially be killed in public for a variety of reasons, right? On the other end of that continuum, you could have an experience like Christian Cooper, where you're largely just feeling insecure. You don't know what's going to happen. You know, you're just going out to do your thing like a lot of other people are doing your thing, but you may get challenged for a variety of reasons. There's a level of insecurity that exists all the time, right? And it is grounded in the legacy of who we've been in terms of how we've thought about race, how we've thought about each other, who we care about, who we love, who counts, whose story matters, and how we show up with that story. So when all this was happening, I had a lot of institutions, a lot of places reach out to me, and I'm really grateful for that. It allowed my work to flourish even more. It allowed me to show up and pay the rent. It allowed me to continue to think creatively about what it meant. I had no idea that it exploded beyond belief, which is one of the reasons there's a degree of exhaustion I feel, but I got to keep going because this is the thing that's happening, right? How do we meet this moment how do we meet this moment? How do I meet this moment? One of those was the New York Botanical Gardens. And the New York Botanical Gardens had reached out to me a little earlier. They wanted me to come do a residency with them. And it was supposed to have been last spring, and it got pushed to the summer, and then it got pushed to this year. And I did a talk for them, and we kept building relationship, having conversations. And finally I said, well, what are you working on right now? So two things happened. One was that I said, well, I'm working on a book and also working on a one-woman performance piece, because I want to, you know, this idea about what if I could have a conversation with John Muir. I served on the National Parks Advisory Board for 8 years as the only African-American. And I lived in California for 8 years as well, where John Muir, as the premier conservationist, is held up. And his narrative about the environment is held up in a very particular way. And I wanted to imagine, what if he and I were in conversation with each other? And they said, why don't you workshop that here? But something else happened in one of our conversations. I started telling them, you know, this idea of how my family story on the land in Westchester got erased. And I, for some reason, so I started telling her the story about this weeping cherry tree. I said, you know, when my family was living on that land back from my parents' 40th wedding anniversary, my parents have now been married something like 65 years. My father had given my mother a weeping cherry tree, Prunus pendula, as a gift. And when they left, right, they couldn't take the tree with them, right? The roots were in the ground. And I really loved thinking about that tree as representative of their presence, our presence on that land. There's no sign on the tree or anything, but just having that knowledge the tree was there. Well, the New York Botanical Gardens as an institution stepped up and said, you know, we're the New York Botanical Gardens. I bet you we could get access to that estate, get a grafting of the tree, bring it back to the New York Botanical Gardens and tell the story of your family. Well, needless to say, I was deeply moved. I told the story of my family hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And this was one of the only times somebody stepped up with an idea that I was like, I think maybe this could happen. At the same time, Irene Taylor, who is an Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, reached out to me. She had seen me in 2019 speak in Telluride. And I had done this short thing called Whose Story Counts. I had come on right after Robert DiAngelo, who did White Fragility, had spoken to this large audience of 900 people. Telluride, man, was an amazing experience. Anyway, a lot of filmmakers in the audience. I didn't meet her that day, but she reached out to me last summer. We had a Zoom call. She's based out in Oregon, a white woman. And she said to me, you know, listen, I've been commissioned to do this documentary for HBO on trees. And what I want to do is talk about certain species of trees in relationship to real people. I believe one of the stories she's going to do, for instance, is about the Weyerhaeuser family, you know, who made their money off timber here in the United States. She said, and I thought about your story, Whose Story Counts, and the idea that she was, I don't have any stories in here about African Americans. And she goes, maybe you could help me think about what that might be. And I said, oh, I'd love to, you know, help think through that with you. And I said, well, if you're going to tell a story about trees in the United States, the obvious thing might be to go to lynching and black people and trees. And she said, yeah, but I'm not the person to do that. And I said, and yeah, you know, we're not just the bad things that happen to us in relationship to trees. And so I said, let me tell you a story and give you an idea of how you might think differently about it. And I told her the story of the weeping cherry tree and my father. It was just to give her some other way to grasp the idea. And that's when she said she liked the story so much. The short of it is she decided that's the story she wanted to tell. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. So we decided to, we reached out to the Westchester Land Trust. So all of this is taking months because it's relationship building. I wasn't here to diminish the Westchester Land Trust for leaving my family out of that letter they sent around. I'm actually not here to diminish anybody. But I wanted to point to it to say like, ooh, maybe we could change this. And to get access to that estate, we need to have them on board. We also need access to the new owners because now there's a new set of owners who don't know my family at all. The owner who had bought the property from the old owners had sold it again. So they don't even know that we ever existed anywhere, right? So there was going to have to be all this relationship building happening. I'm going to come back to that in a second. So the thing that I want to share with you, I'm going to go pop back to the one woman show. So I want you to hold all that for a second. In 2017, Chris Buck is a photographer. He did a thing and it was called, I call it flipping the script. He was also flipping the script. He put out a bunch of images around race. I believe they showed up originally in Oprah's magazine. One of the images is of a young white girl. She might have been 7, 8, 9. she's standing in a toy store and she's looking up at a whole bunch of dolls on a shelf, but all the dolls are black. There's another image of women in a nail salon getting pedicures, but all the women in the chairs getting the pedicures are of Asian descent. All the women giving the pedicures are of European descent, right? So you get that. There's a number of photos like this, so you get where I'm going, right, with him flipping the script. And I've been thinking a lot about flipping the script. I've been thinking about it for a few years. So the N-word, Nature Revisited. Back in 2016, it was a centennial for the national parks. And this was a big deal for anybody interested in national parks. And I'm still on the advisory board at that time, around the country. And my doctorate is in geography. And so at the annual geography conference, the president was putting together a plenary at that conference, the president of the, it's called the AAGs, American Association of American Geographers. And he asked me and about seven other geographers from various parts of the field, would we come together in the plenary and have a conversation? The question he wanted us to think about was, is John Muir still relevant? And he told us in advance, he says, you have 10 minutes to answer that question, so just prepare a 10-minute response. And I thought about that. I said, I knew I was going to be the only black person on the thing. And I said, I have some things to say about it. And I decided to get creative about it, right? I said, okay, how do I want to answer this? Well, a few years earlier, I had read a book. I don't know if any of you know the black author, Alice Randall. Alice Randall, at the time she wrote this book I'm going to talk about now, she was at Harvard. Now, I'm sure most of you know the book Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, made into the movie Gone with the Wind. You know, oh, critical acclaim, critical issues, right? We can have a long conversation about that. Alice Randall asked the question, well, what if Gone with the Wind was written from the point of view of a black woman? And then she decided to write it. So the book is called The Wind Done Gone. It was a New York Times bestseller, I think back in 2003. It also created a row with the Margaret Mitchell estate. So now when you try to buy the book, it has to say a parody on it, even though that's not how Alice wrote it. She wrote it from the point of view of Sinara, Scarlett O'Hara's mulatto half-sister. That's how she wrote it out. So I was thinking about John Muir and some of his works. In particular, I was thinking about his 1,000-mile walk through the Gulf in 1867. In 1867, he took a little more than a year, he was 29 years old, to walk through southern states in Cuba. And what I understand was he was trying to look at the impact of war on the landscape. He was going to Kentucky. He made his way all the way down to Cuba eventually. And I know he got sick and had to return home. And I thought about, what if a black woman wrote it, right? So I actually created a character. I called her Sojourner Washington Douglas. And I took some of Muir's quotes, which I'm going to read to you here. And then I created some quotes from Sojourner Washington Douglas. And I wanted to just share them with the audience in comparison. So I'm going to share them with you here. September 31st, 1867. Muir, quote, escaped from the dust and squalor of his garret bedroom to the glorious forest. He enjoyed the hospitable Kentuckians, met many Negroes who were fat, happy, and contented. September 27th, Muir witnessed the most gorgeous sunset and was directed by a very civil Negro to his lodgings. October 16th, while in Florida, Muir sees an alligator. He learns that, quote, alligators are said to be extremely fond of Negroes and dogs. 1868, in Havana, Cuba, Muir saw the strongest and ugliest Negroes that he had met thus far on his journey. He remarks on the good-natured ugliness that he believed the Negro woman to possess. Here are some quotes from Sojourner Washington Douglas. 1867, it could be your last walk. So you did so carefully. But before that, 1852, Sojourner was born with no last name on Magnolia Plantation in Louisiana. She later adopted the nom de plume of Washington Douglas. 1862, the Homestead Act had passed and white folks were getting free land. Black folks were dreaming of being free. Rumor had it, a new day was coming. 1865, Emancipation Proclamation, black folks began the long walk to freedom across a metaphorical and literal landscape of discarded chains and bodies and dreams deferred and reborn, ducking and weaving as fast as they can. 1866, 400,000 acres of land were given and taken, given and taken to free men and women ducking and weaving across a hostile landscape. 1867, Sojourner sets out for the promised land of the north. Since she's not light-skinned enough to pass for white, she sticks to the back roads and woods, surviving off nature's bounty. 1868, race-related massacres take place across the country, including 200 in her home state of Louisiana. 1873, more massacres, another 70 in Colfax, Louisiana. 1880, Jim Crow is the man. 1890, Jim Crow was the man. 1900, Jim Crow was the man. 1910, Jim Crow was the man. 1920, Jim Crow was the man. 1930, Jim Crow was the man. 1940, Jim Crow was the man. Now, at this point, we hear that Sojourner Washington Douglas has passed away. And Jim Crow was still the man. Then I thought about another book that I had read. I don't know if any of you have ever read the book Rap on Race. Rap on Race is amazing. It's a transcribed conversation between the poet, James Baldwin, and the anthropologist, Margaret Mead. Both brilliant, in my opinion, thoughtful, very different people who sat down to have a conversation about race. I want to say it's back in the early 70s, right? And then it was transcribed. So I imagined, what if I had a conversation with John Muir? Now, I'm not comparing myself to Baldwin or Mead, but I wanted to think about it in terms of difference, how different John Muir and I are, or so it seems. You know, what would it mean for both of us to sit down? I was particularly interested in having this conversation as somebody who spent the better part of 5 years myself backpacking around the world in this skin. And yes, I got a lot of stories to say about that. But that desire, that need to connect, to be out in the world, to feel what does Robert Louis Stevenson say, the feel of the cutting flints beneath your feet, like to feel that and be on the road, what would it be like to be like me to do it or to be like him? So I created this little scene. I was living in Kentucky at the time, right before I moved here. Mr. Muir walks into my living room and me. I say, please sit down, Mr. Muir. Mr. Muir, utterly distracted by his surroundings. Thank you. After dispensing with niceties, because I was brought up right, I would waste no time and have to call him out on some of his views expressed in his 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf in 1867, speaking of Negroes as largely lazy and easygoing, not able to, quote, pick as much cotton as a white man. Me. Woe, my wilderness brother! What you saw was not laze in their eyes, but glaze in their eyes and fire in their heart. Can you imagine the crushing blow to their humanity that Black people, we don't use the term Negro anymore, Mr. Muir, felt on a regular basis being enslaved while planting and harvesting and building the backbone of our economy, while being another human being's property? Can you imagine the depth of spirit necessary to survive that wilderness of pain and gain, of life not imagined and lived on one's own terms? Mr. Muir, eyes wide, silence. I might offer him some green tea in a recyclable cup right about now, just as he appears to look a bit shaken. I could forgive Mr. Muir his confused and stunned silence. I imagine that at most he might have envisioned me cleaning his house, not snapping his retorts into reluctant submission. So I soften. Take a deep breath, Mr. Muir. Close your eyes and see yourself in your beloved Yosemite. Find your center, my wilderness brother, and let me share with you a few thoughts. Muir, I can do that. He closes his eyes somewhat reluctantly. I tell him stories of my parents and the land they cared for deeply. I tell him that I've never been to Muir Woods. The steam rising from his green tea could not hide his surprise, but I do have a fondness for the baobab tree and the cherry blossom tree. I tell him that I've gone to Yosemite where I have met a Black park ranger who is holding it down with his heart and music from his flute. I tell him about the city and the rose that grew from concrete even when no one else cared, but I leave out Tupac because that would be too much new information at one time. I tell him that the wilderness is not only those vast natural expanses we can see, but they are also those places vast and unfamiliar that many of us occupy in our daily lives. And they are worthy of our preservation and our care. The stories, the natures, the lives that he did not know how to know. Me. I know that was a lot, Mr. Muir. Perhaps you need to take some notes. Muir. Ah, yes, as he is writing, I would like to meet that Black park ranger with a flute. Me. Ah, Shelton Johnson. I think he would like to meet you too. He brought the story of the Buffalo Soldiers back to Yosemite. He also got to meet Oprah, who did a special on her experience in Yosemite National Park. But again, I decided not to share that, as that story would be too much information for Mr. Muir at this time. Muir, thank you for the visit. I need time to process all you have shared with me today. I must be going. Nature calls. Me, thinking, does he mean he needs to go to the bathroom? But before I can ask, he is out the door. I shout out after him. No worries, Mr. Muir. I've got your back, even if you don't have mine. And that's for me, like the point I wanted to make when I was at the conference was, it's actually not about his story or my story. It is about our story together, that I decide on my terms, like where we meet. What I wrote here, what I wrote in my piece was that it becomes transparent on my terms, you know, that I engage him on my terms, that my story is no longer erased and invisible, and I don't have to diminish him to make my story mean something or my story count. All I actually need him to do is meet me where I am, so I can meet him where he is, and we decide who we want to be as we move forward and what that looks like. The thing that I want to say here before I sort of sign off and go to questions is that I want to come back to the cherry tree. Around December of this year, we'd all decided that we were going to do this thing, go get this grafting, tell the story. It's going to be on HBO. Isn't this going to be a beautiful story? When the Westchester Land Trust got on the land to make sure the tree was still there and see its condition, they sent me a picture. And if I had pictures here, I could have shown you the before of the tree and the after of the tree, which was near the gardener's cottage where I grew up. The tree was gone. Somebody had cut it down. And I have to tell you that for 3 days, I was devastated. I was angry. I was depressed. When I showed it to the filmmaker, she was devastated. And I was like, the whole story is dead in the water. But I realized in my gut, I was just like, isn't this what always happens? This is what always happens. We remain invisible. The story moves nowhere. We don't count, you know. And then after 3 days, I thought about it and I said, wait a minute. This is the story. It is a story of erasure. It is a story of loss. It is a story of deep connection. It is a story of nature. This is the story we should tell. And I thought about it for a little longer. And then I said, what if we all decided to replant another weeping cherry tree? What if I could get everybody on board? And it took a minute, but the New York Botanical Gardens said yes. The Westchester Land Trust said yes. They said, and we'll actually get the tree. And that's good, because honestly, I don't know anything about planting trees. Then I had to write a personal letter to the owners. The owners are a couple who are medical doctors who don't know me, who don't know my family. And I wrote a letter where I never mentioned the word race once. But I did mention what it means to be a human being, what I felt not being able to honor my family's story. My father's got Alzheimer's now, so he remembers very little, but he talks about that land. My mother needs 24-hour care all the time and feels alone and separated, right? I wanted to, what could we do together here? And the beautiful thing is she wrote me back in 20 minutes and said yes. So on July 18th, I spent July in New York doing these readings and doing this residency. We all descended upon this estate, a land that my family and I hadn't had access to for 18 years. The president of the land trust and the forester, the owner, the filmmaker, as well as an additional young Black filmmaker who came up, a woman who worked for me with me for 6 months as a dramaturge. There was about 8 or 10 of us, the camera guys, the love that was there, the attention, the sense of the sacred that was there. You can see that I get really emotional really easily, because it was there. I wear it on my sleeve around that. And to have such graciousness, to have such love, such making space for that. And everybody participated in the replanting of this new tree. And for me, that's the story that I want to tell going forward. What does remembering look like when done collectively? What does accountability look like when we are all accountable to all of our stories? What does responsibility to that? The young forester who largely planted the tree said he will go back every year and he's going to take photos and he's going to check on it. The owner who is there will be looking at, the hack will look at it. They're going to see it every day outside of their window. The New York Botanical Gardens as an institution has that story as part of their story of who they can be. Now, this doesn't change anything that's ever happened in the past in terms of white people and black people or brown people or any kind of people that's different. But what it does is offer a different way to think about how we move forward. So the last thing that I want to say is I learned a term, a Japanese term called kintsugi. I was able to spend about 4 years. I was going back and forth to Japan to teach there a few years ago. But I learned this term. I learned this term not long ago, that kintsugi is about, you know, if a piece of pottery is broken, that what the Japanese do, they don't throw out the pieces. They put the pieces back together, but they use gold in order to do it. So not only do you never forget what was broken, but you mend it. You bring to it love. You bring to it attention. You bring to it intention. You don't bring to it shame or fear or guilt. You actually show up to it and you learn from it and you think about how you move forward. Yes, it is about taking risks, not risk to hold on to who we've been and what we have, but risks in order to gain something new, risks in order to create an emergent space for all of us to show up indifferently, to meet each other where we all are at this moment, and to do so with intention, courage, and love. Thank you.
Carolyn, thank you so very much. I know I feel it. I didn't just hear it, I feel it. We have a tiny bit of time left, and so I think we have time enough for one question, so I'll throw one out. And because I'm the moderator, I'm going to ask one of my own. I'm sure that many of us in the audience, and certainly myself, want to be doing the right thing in making the outdoors of this region, at least everywhere, more inclusive, more welcoming, to stop the erasure of the history of the story. But I, at least, still feel like I'm flying blind, and I'm fearful of doing the wrong thing. What advice can you offer us?
Thank you for that question, Ryan. Yeah. Well, this is something that I would say to anybody, and I will say it to you and say it to your audience as well, that you know what, you will make a mistake. Actually, you'll probably make a lot of them. But you'll make those mistakes not because of the color of your skin. You'll make those mistakes because you're a human being. Of course you're going to make mistakes. Like, I don't make mistakes. Yeah, I make mistakes. We all make mistakes. The question for me is not doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing. It's when you make the mistakes, how do you show up to it? How do you show up to that? That's where we learn the most. That's where we develop trust. That's how we take the risk. Now, how do you show up and say, God, I'm really sorry, you know, and how do I show up to that? And you know what? You know, sometimes how you make a mistake and people still don't want anything to do with you. So you have to also be prepared for the possibility that someone's not going to still embrace you with open arms, but you're still going to show up anyway. That's where we build our backbone, our strength. We build that muscle. Let me say that, not so much backbone. We build that muscle about being able to understand that sometimes we have to show up to the no. And that's where the learning is, so that we don't make that mistake again. You know, that's the primary thing I would say. I mean, I could say 100 other things from, well, yeah, you know, you read, you learn, you grow. And I want to say, take what you know. How do you, what does it mean to meet people where you are? Where does it, where, what does it mean to not judge someone, but actually discern instead? What does it mean not to cancel anyone out? But sometimes you have to call someone or something out in order to call them in, right? You know, I'm not interested in canceling out John Muir. I did last summer when the first public conversation about John Muir was coming out in the paper, his great-great-grandson, Robert Hanna, reached out to me because he was so overwhelmed by the press wanting his response and his family's response, and he did not want to have this conversation in the mainstream press, and he asked me to do a podcast with him about it. And as we started, and he introduced me to his audience, you know, it was online like this, and he said, you know, I reached out to Carolyn because, you know, all the mainstream media was calling me. My phone was ringing off the hook. It was so bad. I thought something had happened to a member of my family. And I interrupted him and I said, that's because something did happen to a member of your family. That's the thing to remember. You know, these people are belong to, John Muir is related to people. There's a legacy there. And he isn't only one thing, because none of us are only one thing. And he did change over time. And I'm not saying we shouldn't hold him accountable. But if we don't understand how do you create space so that someone can find redemption, then what are we actually talking about? Because all of us will end up on the canceled side of that equation. And that's a zero sum equation, right? I'm not interested in that. I'm interested what happens when we really understand what redemption means. What does it mean to heal for each of us and all of us? What does it mean to be accountable, right? It's not about being comfortable. You know, wow, that if that's all we're interested in, that we've set the bar really low. You know, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't all want to feel safe. I don't think comfort and safe are the same thing. So I want to make sure that I say that.
Well, I think that is very wise advice to end on. Thank you again, Carolyn, for sharing your time and your words with us. Yeah. To everyone, we hope you've enjoyed today's live broadcast of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you for your support. And this concludes our unique 2021 season.